You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to episode 69 of the Apple Insider Podcast. We're recording on Thursday, the 19th of May, 2016. Joining me today is our editor-in-chief, Neil Hughes.
Hey, Victor, how's it going?
Today, if you're willing, I want to talk about all things iPad, Mac, Apple, iOS, and
more. All right,
ready?
I'm ready.
Fantastic. I'm going to start off by asking you about Google I.O. And I know that I just said that we were talking all about all things Mac, but this has a tail because Google released a speaker that looks as if it's trying to take on HomeKit and Siri.
It's kind of simultaneously taking on HomeKit, Siri, and the Amazon Echo Alexa platform.
Now, it's I'm not sure. I mean, that is it a HomeKit compatible thing? Or no, it's not compatible, but it's a HomeKit-like thing at this time?
Yeah, so it's a standalone speaker that plugs into the wall. And it has like a powerful speaker in it. So it's meant for listening to music and kind of also taking on Apple's AirPlay. So unlike the Amazon Echo, which is more of a feedback device and you really wouldn't want to use it to listen to music, this is actually something that you could listen to music on. And also get weather, get news, get whatever. And it'll do all of those things and control devices in your home as well. So connect to smart home accessories, not HomeKit. It'll be whatever Google's calling their version of their HomeKit these days.
Yeah. So Google has, of course, the Works with Nest stuff, but they also have they have Brillo, Thread, and Weave.
Yeah, I can't keep track of it all.
So I've been spending some time memorizing this. So for our listeners, Brillo is the OS that Google wants third-party manufacturers to run on their products. So when you buy a light bulb, they want you to put Brillo in it. And Brillo is basically a really shrunk-down version of Android that fits on a chip inside there. And they've been having some trouble with it. It's been difficult for them to shoehorn Android into that small kind of a thing. But they're trying. Weave is, and any of our listeners who know this better than I do, please call and correct me. Please go ahead and email me. But Weave is the framework that says that I know that a light bulb can turn on, off, have color and dim, or that a ceiling fan can have rotation and which direction kind of thing. And Thread is the protocol for sending that communication. So that, you know, when you have a Thread device, for example, within Nest, the one Thread device that's actually shipping is the Yale Linus lock. And because it's a Thread device, it announces itself to Nest. It pops up in Nest's app. And all of them collect within Nest's
app. I write about this stuff for a living, and I can't follow it all. So that tells you how the average consumer probably feels about this stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. And just recently, Google allowed people to have access to those developer APIs. And it's still a very
Google Home is going to play into this by allowing you to control those devices with your voice. It's an always listening device that can play music, answer questions, control things, just kind of a catch-all. And you can swap some of the exterior stuff on it to match the decor of your home so it's not this ugly thing.
You can change the speaker grill to a different fashion color.
It's an interesting product. We don't know. It's coming later this year. We don't know how much it's going to cost. But it seems like a way more capable version of Amazon Echo. That does a lot more.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because when it ships, it's not going to do anything with third-party hardware yet. So that's going to like Alexa, like HomeKit, like any of these things. It takes some time to get developers to ramp up their own hardware to match. So getting it on board with third-party stuff is going to be initially a little slow, although I would expect something like Philips Hue to work almost the same week that it launches just because it's so dead simple, and Philips has done a good job of exposing
that
to everyone.
And they've been on the market
so developers can do what they
want. There's no excuse.
Yeah. Well, their APIs are out there. People write Philips Hue apps all the time, so it's well understood. The audio portion of it, they're basically just using Chromecast audio and building the Chromecast audio receiver into the speaker.
But it's also going to integrate with Chromecast, so you can, for example, control content on your Chromecast using your Google Home, and they'll play nice with each other.
Yes, it's building that part of the app that selects content and wakes up and sends it to the Chromecast video product.
Yep.
And the way Chromecast works, for our listeners who don't know, is that instead of streaming the music from your phone or device like that over your local network, so you're pulling it down from outside to your phone and then from your phone pushing it to Chromecast, the way that Chromecast works is that you browse something on your phone, or in this case, Google Home, and then tell it where you want it to play. And that device goes and gets it from the internet directly. So it eliminates the sort of internal house hop.
So let's put all this in perspective, because I have a theory on all this.
Okay.
So Google Home is, especially when you pair it with a Chromecast, doing a lot of what people hope that the new Apple TV would do. There was a lot of hope before it was announced that the new Apple TV might be a crucial part of HomeKit. That is to say, have its own built-in speaker and microphone, always be listening, and allow you to control your HomeKit devices or talk to Siri as you're making dinner in the kitchen or something like that.
And we clearly
didn't get that. And I think the reason that we didn't get that is because you can tell by the way that the fourth generation Apple TV is designed with the Siri remote. Apple is very reluctant to create a device that is going to make people feel uncomfortable that they're constantly being listened to. I think that that's a very conscious thing that Apple is doing, where they don't want to come across as creepy and selling you a device that is listening while you're, you know, hanging around the house. And so,
well, and they're right to do that, right? We've seen backlash before with Samsung TVs and Vizio TVs,
right,
where Samsung had a microphone and was actively listening, or Vizio simply tracks what you watch and phones home.
So the design of the Siri remote is very conscious decision. It has a dedicated button on it that you must hold down, and only then is it listening, and that shows you a prompt on the screen letting you know that your Apple TV is listening. Otherwise, it's not listening.
Right. And if you were a conspiracy theorist, then you could suspect that it could be listening anyway, button or no, or interface on the TV.
But for the
no.
average person, it's friendly and it feels safer the way that it's designed. It's done that way,
yeah,
in a way.
You have to invoke
it. So that's a reason, I think, that we haven't seen an Amazon, Alexa, Google Home type product from Apple yet. But I have a theory on that. So story came out this week showing Siri in OS 10.12 or Mac OS 10.12, whatever they're going to call it. And it's pretty widely accepted at WWDC, we're going to get Siri on the Mac. Now, in that leak, it was also said that in the settings, someone who toyed around with this apparently found that Hey Siri was turned off by default on the Mac. So I think if you're thinking about this from Apple's perspective, and you maybe want to get into this market where you have a device that's always listening that can control your stuff, but you don't want to creep out, Joe Public and make them feel uncomfortable about your product, how do you start getting into that space? Well, you have your iPhone that has...
You copy what Google Chrome did 4 years ago with OK Google by putting it into Mac and having the Mac respond to Hey Siri?
Potentially. But you have it off by default. You have it on your phone. You're slowly introducing it in these devices and having that functionality there. But having a dedicated set-top box that does nothing but listen to you comes across as a little too creepy. I think that, you know, if you were to have a Mac that you could... plug a microphone into, and you know, even if it were to listen for Hey Siri commands in low power mode or in standby mode when your laptop is closed or something like that, I think that's a roundabout way for Apple to start addressing that market. But especially if you're doing it with, you know, optional things that must be turned on your iPhone or your Mac, you're kind of relegating it to power users, people that are opting in, people that know what they're getting into, people that are comfortable with this feature. As opposed to having something, you know, that's always on, always listening, sitting in your house and having that creep factor.
Right. So here, it's an interesting thing because people were very creeped out by Vizio and Samsung. People were not at all creeped out by Alexa because they love the idea of being in the kitchen and saying, set a timer for, you know, whatever's cooking.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is when you buy a TV, you're not looking for that. You're not looking for something that's always listening to you. When you buy a device that's entire job is to always listen to you, you know what you're getting into. And so that's one of the reasons that you can't just sell an Apple TV that's always listening, because a lot of people are buying it and don't want to talk to it.
They're buying it
for Netflix.
Yeah,
they want to use Netflix. They don't really care. And if they get something and then they find out, oh, this thing's always listening to me and listening for commands, that could be a detriment to the product. So I think that it's just different because the Amazon Alexa is a specific product for a specific purpose. And by buying it, you're essentially opting in.
Got it.
So what if the Mac becomes the opt-in device for Apple? You know, it's always listening.
Then that's a very expensive analog to Alexa.
It is, but you also are leaving it to users who kind of know what they're getting into as well.
True.
And I wonder if bringing Siri to the Mac might be that last element that, you know, that really makes to a point where do you really need something like Alexa if your phone works with it, if your Mac works with it? How much do you need it when your other devices are doing the same thing?
Well, you know, let's talk about what Amazon's path forward is here, right? What Amazon's thinking of is that they want not only to build this into their products, but they want everyone to build it into their third-party stuff. We saw that with Trilby, the thing that you put on the refrigerator is the first Amazon Alexa third-party right. product. They've given their sources for doing this out on GitHub, and people can run Alexa on a Raspberry Pi. You do have to use a button to invoke it, same as you do with the remote on Apple TV. And what they want is for people to build Alexa into every third-party product, and then they don't have to worry about where the mics are, and everything just happens.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. Alexa, Google Now, Google Assistant, whatever they're calling it these days, they're all way better than Siri. Siri has gained some minor functionality since it launched
you break
in 2011, but let's be real. Siri is not nearly at the level that it should be right now. They've had four and a half years since introducing Siri. It debuted in 2011 on the iPhone 4S. Think about that.
Well, and they're losing all the original employees to Viv, which is by the founder of Siri.
It's 4.5 years is a lifetime in the world of technology. The fact that Siri does not work as well as competing products, isn't as fast, isn't as good, doesn't give you the answers that you're looking for, doesn't tap into the data sources that you want it to tap into.
Don't pull any punches here, Neil.
I wrote a story a couple weeks ago about the original Siri team leaving, and I took a screenshot I recorded on my iPad with Hey Siri to just have an illustration for the story. So I said, Siri, where are you going? Siri said, who, me? And I said, yes, everybody's leaving. Siri said, I figured as much. And I said, but where are they going? And it interpreted as, but where are they going? And then it said, I'm not sure I understand. And then I said, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. And Siri said, I don't know what you mean by I guess I shouldn't be surprised. How about a web search for it? You know? And so, and someone in the comments, you know, said something about how I wasn't speaking clearly to Siri and I was purposely trying to trip it up for the purposes of this story. And it's like, no, you know, when I say Siri, where are you going?
She can do that all on her own, right. Friend. You don't have to work.
I mean, it works well enough, you know, but when you're comparing it to the competition and what the competition can do, and especially this Vive or Vive or whatever that's coming out, however they pronounce it, there are way, way better options on the market right now than Siri. And the fact that Apple was first to market with this in terms of an integrated, built into the platform, virtual digital assistant, and that they have fallen behind everybody is inexcusable and is another example of how Apple, when it comes to services, just struggles.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we're going to see Home, and Home is going to take on all these things. Is there a reason why our listeners should look for more things like this? Should they be interested in Home?
Yeah, I mean, if Apple doesn't address this market, then there's definitely going to be you know, a desire to have something like this that works better. You know, the hope is that this year at WWDC, some major improvements to Siri are announced in iOS 10 and OS 10.12. And I mean, on the Apple Watch, you know, if I use Hey Siri with my Apple Watch, I can do a 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. I can get all the way up to 5. And it takes that long to even acknowledge my request. So I think, you know, on the Apple Watch, it's a processing issue. I think on the phone, it's a cloud issue where a lot of the data processing and stuff is done in the cloud and not on the phone itself. And then I think even when it returns results, that's just an algorithm and software programming issue with Apple. The issues with Siri are many. And as you see products like Alexa continue to improve and expand and Google Home make it to market, that's just Apple falling further and further behind. So I think the hope for Apple aficionados and fans for this year would be let's see some major improvements to the Siri platform and to its performance announced at WWDC in June.
Definitely. I'm beginning to experiment with Alexa a little bit. And one of the things that I kind of like about it is the idea that it's not beholden to Android or iOS at this point. It's very much its own kind of thing. I still have a lot of love for HomeKit, but what I'm finding is that some of my HomeKit accessories are also Alexa compatible. So I get the best of both worlds.
That's great. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I want to take a moment to mention some of our killer deals, which are available to our U.S. consumers. And actually, I don't know why they wouldn't be available other than shipping to anyone else. But if you're looking for a 2015 12-inch MacBook, you can grab a model for an all-time low of $964 with no sales tax in 48 states and three accessories. Or you can grab a late 2013 27-inch iMac with HD display for $1,299 with no tax outside of New York. So if you go to appleinsider.com and you look for our killer deals and just search our webpage for killer deals, you will find this deal there. And what's going on is that Apple-authorized reseller Adorama dropped their pricing across the board on its 2015 12-inch MacBook inventory. They already offer Apple Insider price guide shoppers an additional $35 off each model with the promo code Apple Insider. That's AP Insider. And you have to apply that before payment during checkout. So you end up getting the lowest price ever offered for a 12-inch MacBook to date. I know. I broke the flow of conversation, but I wanted to share that with all of our listeners because, well, cool. I have a good friend, actually, who's got an iMac, and his iMac started acting flaky. And I told him he should go get a MacBook. He ended up getting a 13-inch MacBook Pro. He's very happy with it. So it's definitely worth checking out these kinds of deals. Now, also at I/O was the announcement that Android Pay is coming to ATMs and mobile Chrome users.
Yeah, I mean, I think the announcement was kind of a misnomer because Apple Pay could be working at ATMs in the U.S. as well. It's just that the ATMs don't have NFC support built in. But you can use Apple Pay at ATMs in China.
Yeah. And I've heard some rumblings about Apple Pay coming to ATMs in the U.S.
It's just a matter of the ATMs updating to support. I mean, my debit card already supports Apple Pay. So if Wells Fargo ever decided to add NFC to their ATMs, then presumably it would work there.
Well, yes and no. It should. But the banks are really, really weird about this. So, for example, your card had to be enabled for Apple Pay at the bank for them to allow you to use it. That meant that the bank had to get on board with Apple and doing Apple Pay early on in order to get all those things in a row. But just because they've gotten on board with Apple Pay does not mean that your card will work with Android Pay or any other NFC system.
Right.
And so just because they're enabling their ATMs for Android Pay does not necessarily mean, although it should, it doesn't necessarily mean that it'll work with Apple Pay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would think that since my bank debit card already works with Apple Pay, you would think that if they were to roll it out at their ATM, it's going to work. But they just don't have hardware support at the ATMs.
Yeah. If they do the tap to pay kind of standard support there, it should work. But there's always room for a bank to screw something right up. You know, this is payments. It's very intricate. There are a lot of pit holes, and they will find a way to screw it up. So you've got the only coin product, right? The coin wallet?
Yes, I have coin.
And you have the 2.0 version, which is both NFC
so
and
so what happened was I had no real interest in coin. I didn't see the need for this product. It was
Mikey loved this thing, right? Mikey,
that's how I got it. So it turned out that they announced the product, and if you pre-ordered it, they didn't ship on time. So then they said, we'll ship you two. So Mikey had a spare one that he had sent to me last fall. So I have two versions of coin. I have the original version, and then I was just sent last week. Mikey looked into it and found out that you had to reach out to coin to get the second version. They didn't just mail it to you by default. You had to request it. So a couple weeks ago, I emailed Coin and I was like, hey, can I get version 2.0? And they said, yeah, sure. And then it arrived last week. And then this week it was announced that Fitbit has bought the company and they are no longer shipping their product. They're end of life, essentially. So I'm not really sure what Fitbit wants to do with this company, because the product that Coin made was designed to spoof your credit card. And that doesn't really tie in with what Fitbit does.
Well, it was designed to spoof your credit card for the swipe purchases. But for the NFC purchases, it shouldn't be.
Well, that's part of the problem as well. So it was designed to spoof your card for swipe purchases back before NFC was becoming more commonplace. They announced the product. It took them so long to get to market that they didn't ship until about a month before chip and pin switch took place in October of last year.
Never mind that that migration didn't necessarily happen smoothly for anyone else.
Didn't happen smoothly, but so I had the coin. I used it for a little while before chip and pin took place. Here's how it works. If you take your coin to a place that has a chip and pin reader enabled, that where you have to put in the chip part of the card, coin won't work.
You have to dip your
coin card. Won't work because coin can't spoof the chip. It only spoofs the swipe. Coin, for those that don't know, is about the thickness of maybe a credit card and a half. And
what was the point of the product?
It is designed to be one credit card to hold all of your credit cards. So it has a ultra thin battery inside of it. It's an impressive design, I got to say. And there's a reader on the back that will dynamically, digitally change to display the card that you have selected. So on the front, there is a flat button and a like an old calculator style LCD display, and you press the button and it'll connect to your phone over Bluetooth to verify that your card wasn't stolen, and then it'll show you the name of your card, and you can flip through, find your card, and then when you're wherever, you hand the card over and they swipe it, and then the reader on the back will change to spoof the swipe of your credit card. The problem is, by the time this product shipped, credit card companies were already trying to depreciate the swipe capability of their credit cards because it's not as secure as having a chip. So we started to switch to chip and signature in the US last October. Readers started switching over. Coin doesn't work in those kind of readers if the merchant has disabled swipe on their reader. Or if you swipe
the card. Your bank has to have been on board for the card to work with coin in order for the NFC to happen.
Yes, that's part of it. I'm talking about coin 1.0. So when I had coin 1.0.
Okay. I was moving on to 2.0.
So when I had coin 1.0, half the time the swipe wouldn't work. You know, go to the store, go to the grocery store, go to a restaurant, go to a bar. You'd hand them the card. They'd either go off and lose a connection to the phone and it was locked and they'd come back, or the swipe wouldn't work. And it just got to a point where it was embarrassing. And I was like, well, I'm just not going to use this product anymore. So I got Coin 2 last week and I added in my cards and did all that. Well, when you go through on their app, it shows you which of your cards has approved, because now it has NFC built in. So tap to pay, just like Apple Pay. It shows you which of your cards have approved NFC for Coin. I have 3 credit cards and a debit card. Only my debit card is approved for NFC, and I don't use my debit card for purchases. So Coin 2.0.
Congratulations. You're lucky that you had one of
them. Coin 2.0 is absolutely worthless to me. So my Wells Fargo card works, Discover and Capital One Quicksilver, and my Amazon card don't work. So if you have those cards, don't bother. Ain't worth it. The swipe will still work if a merchant accepts swipe. But the problem is, if your credit card has been updated to a chip card, which all of mine have, those cards are now known to reject the swipe if swiped at a reader that accepts chip and pin. So your swipes at any chip and pin reader that's enabled will automatically be rejected by the credit card company, even if you're using a product like Coin or if you're swiping your traditional credit card.
Yeah. Now, I have a product that's kind of similar to this called a Walkit. And the Walkit is this thing where it's got a card in it and the card is programmable and it docks into this wallet that has a touchscreen and has all your cards in it. And it will program the swipe for that. The NFC is actually just in the wallet dock kind of thing that you carry around.
Interesting. Does it work?
And you tap to pay with that. And I'd tell you that it works wonderfully, except that none of my cards are approved for using Walkit for NFC.
So I was pretty excited about a product a few years ago that was announced that never actually came out. Had you heard of Wallaby?
I have heard
of Wallaby. So Wallaby was a cool concept, and I'd like to see Apple do something like this. So what it did was, and I don't think Apple will ever do it, but it would be awesome. So what Wallaby did was it knew all your credit cards, and it knew all the – because a lot of these card companies like Discover have rotating bonuses. So every 3 months, you'll have to opt in on an email, and then they'll say for the next 3 months, you get an extra 1% cash back on top of your regular cash back bonus on purchases at grocery stores and movie theaters or something like that. And so it can be hard to keep track of this crap, especially when every 3 months they change it up. And it's like, wait, which one am I getting more back in restaurants this month? Which one am I getting more back in groceries?
Yeah, it sounds like an annoying
thing
to track.
So what Wallaby did was it was just a traditional credit card. You would swipe it, the transaction would go to Wallaby, and then they would forward the transaction to your credit card company, and they would handle the transaction end of it essentially. So they were like a middleman. And what they would do is they intelligently knew, oh, well, you have a Discover card. Discover card is doing bonus cash back for the next 3 months on groceries. So we're going to put this on your Discover card. So you never had to worry about which card to use. You always swiped one card. It worked like a normal credit card. And they handled the transaction on the back end of it.
Wow.
It never actually came out. So
no, but Apple could certainly do that because they already have everyone's iTunes accounts with credit cards associated
exactly.
with it.
So, you know, all Apple needs to do is plug into and have an algorithm or somebody, you know, Android Pay or whatever, that knows the benefits and the bonuses on your credit cards, and they could do something like that. And I think it'd be pretty cool. I don't know how much the credit card companies would like that, though.
So here's what I'm thinking. We're going with Fitbit, right? Fitbit, we know that swipe doesn't matter, so that part of coin goes away. Fitbit goes ahead and they put the NFC chip and allow credit card information entered in through the Fitbit app. And they're going to have to do the hard work of getting all the banks on board with having Fitbit used as a method of transaction, but as a payment card. But everyone who's got a new Fitbit with, you know, a rumored new Fitbit, I'm making up the rumor, with an NFC chip in it, suddenly can pay by risk.
But here's what I don't understand. 100% of Coin's effort was put into designing this ultra slim swipeable card. They only added NFC as a reaction to the fact that their card wasn't working as of last October at a lot of retailers. What is stopping? Why did Fitbit have to buy Coin? Why didn't they just put their own NFC and work out their own relationships with banks? I mean, Fitbit is a known brand and a publicly traded company. It's not like they needed the Coin cachet, so to speak, in order to build relationships with banks, as established by the fact that Coin is only working right now with my Wells Fargo card and no major credit cards. What relationships did Coin have that Fitbit really wants to cash in on? I mean, I can't, unless they got Coin for pennies on the dollar of what they're worth, I don't really see the purpose of buying them. All of their IP was into creating this very impressive thin card, very impressive, but it's worthless.
Okay, so there are a couple of reasons why they'd buy them, right? Just hypothetically, you buy them, like you said, for the relationships with banks or payment people. So they had Wells Fargo, and did they have Visa or MasterCard at all?
Not according to the cards I swiped in. I don't have a MasterCard, but I have two Visas, and neither of them.
Well, so the way that this works is they can have a relationship with Visa and MasterCard at the Visa and MasterCard level, but if they don't have it with the issuing bank of those Visa and MasterCard cards, then those cards
don't
work.
Well, I have two Visas, one through Amazon and one through Capital One, and neither of them work, so.
Right, but if you'd had one through Bank of America, for example, then perhaps it might have, hypothetically.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess my debit card technically
is a Visa. It's down to that
well.
Issuing bank.
So that's a Wells Fargo thing. But I mean, all these cards work with Apple Pay. So
yeah, but Apple went ahead and did the work to get everyone on board.
But that's what I'm wondering. Why can't Fitbit just go? I mean, they're a publicly traded company. It's not like Coin is a known quantity.
Well, so you buy it for that, right? For those relationships. You buy it for the users. They shipped 250,000 of these coins, and they can have 250,000 new Fitbit users.
I guess, but it's two totally different markets. I can't see that someone who owns Coin is going to go, oh, wow, I wasted $100 on this thing that doesn't work, and they immediately discontinued it. Now I really want to buy a Fitbit.
Okay. And the other reason you do it is for the expertise, developer talent.
Well, I think it's a dumb deal. I think it was a waste of money on – we don't know what Fitbit paid for Coin. Maybe they paid basically nothing. I think it was a dying and dead company anyhow. They were on their way out. Clearly, they didn't need to buy them for their intellectual property or their design team or their talent. So I don't really see what Fitbit gets from this deal other than a way of signaling to Wall Street that they plan to get into the payment space without announcing that they're going to get into the payment space.
We know that Fitbit and Apple are, you know, fighting for some of the same real estate on your body, right? They're both fighting for the wrist, and Fitbit has the bulk of the share, especially at the lower cost devices, and Apple is trailing, right?
Right.
So is this another way for Fitbit to remain relevant?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they see what's coming.
We just don't know why they had to buy
a coin.
Yeah,
I mean, they
could
put an NFC chip. I mean, these chips are so small they can fit into a flat coin card, so put an NFC chip in your next Fitbit and work out relationships with the banks. It's not like, I mean, Fitbit is a much bigger name than Coin. If you're going to the negotiating table as Coin, you have no clout. In fact, you're bypassing credit card companies and spoofing their cards. They're going to be mad at you for it, which is why a lot of them didn't establish relationships with Coin. Whereas Fitbit is a known brand and they want to do NFC, which is, it could have, offer more security. I don't understand the deal. It makes no sense to me.
All right. Well, here's to us getting Fitbits next year that have NFC chips in them and reviewing them for Apple Insider. All right. And that's something that we'll be doing more of in the future, is we're going to continue with our review series, and we've got some fitness things on deck, I think. I want to talk briefly about, because we talked about public company. You said Fitbit's a public company. So what is the story here with George Soros and Warren Buffett and Mr. Trump?
Well, basically what happened was, a few weeks ago, Carl Icahn announced that he had sold completely out of his position in Apple. He was citing concerns in China. Apple's sales in China last quarter were down 26% year over year. And then another big hedge fund manager, David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital, in late 2015 had sold a considerable amount of shares in Apple as well. He's recently bought more, but there's been a lot of hand-wringing over Apple's future performance, and their stock is trading at like a two-year low right now. They've lost some $250 billion in market cap. So it's tough times for Apple on Wall Street. So you're seeing the pendulum kind of swing back the other way. So on Monday, it was revealed that Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, his fund had bought $1 billion worth of Apple stock. They traditionally don't invest in tech stocks. So for them to buy into Apple was kind of a big deal and a big announcement. Following that, George Soros, it was revealed, also has a share in Apple, although that's more of a Jeopardy trivia question than anything else. Soros' share in Apple is incredibly small. He only has 3,100 shares, so $338,000 nice. For me or you might be a lot of money, but for somebody like George Soros, it's not a considerable sum, but worth noting that he bought in. And then the third leg of that story is Donald Trump, no pun intended there, by the way, who, since he apparently likes to talk about his manhood, it was revealed.
Oh dear. Come on.
He did it during a presidential debate. I mean, that's just
this is a family rated show.
I said
on
nothing
iTunes.
Inappropriate. This is a man who talked about his anatomy during a presidential debate. So I think it's fair game. It was revealed that he has between 1.1 million and 2.25 million in Apple shares, per a disclosure that was made this week. The reason that that's noteworthy, 1.1 million is a lot of money again for you and I, not a lot of money for Donald Trump, who has a net worth of $4 billion, most of his money being in real estate. But it's noteworthy because Donald Trump had made waves a few months back calling for a boycott of Apple. He took the side of the U.S. government in the encryption debate over the San Bernardino shooting, saying that Apple should build a backdoor for iOS and assist the FBI in breaking into the phone. He then at that time declared that he was going to boycott Apple. He ceased tweeting from his iPhone for a whopping 3 weeks and then forgot about it and moved on, as a lot of this campaign seems to have gone, with a lot of talk and rhetoric immediately dropped. And it's also relevant because Trump has been making waves as well, talking about how he plans to make Apple manufacture its products in the U.S. The quote from him was, "We're going to get Apple to build their damn computers in this country instead of other countries." He plans to do that if elected president by imposing a 35% tax on businesses that make their goods overseas. Apple currently makes their Mac Pro, or assembles their Mac Pro, in the U.S. The logistics of assembling an iPhone in the U.S. would basically be impossible. And it's a pie in the
sky. And I'd like to point out for our non-U.S. listeners and our listeners who failed civics classes, that presidents don't impose taxes.
I mean,
Congress writes tax law. Presidents can talk about whatever they want, but presidents don't get to decide unilaterally that they're going to impose
taxes. I mean,
tax
the president does have the power to impose protectionist tariffs. But the logistics of him doing something like that would be not only politically disastrous, potentially, and economically disastrous, but for a self-described conservative who promotes free market.
that's not how I would describe Mr. Trump at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to get too political here, but regardless, the kind of stuff that he's promoting is not, it would not be free market, as many conservatives.
Or conservative.
Right. So realistically, it would never happen. You know, he can rattle his saber and say that kind of stuff. But it was just worth noting, and we did in a story this week, just because he's talked a lot about how he's going to boycott Apple. And not only did he stop boycotting Apple, but he also owns stock in the company.
Nice. Very, very nice. Can we talk about iPhone 7, please?
That's what the people want. Give the people what they want.
Let's delay giving the people what they want. Let's talk about India. Let's talk about China.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about India.
Well, basically, a few announcements this week from Apple. They're expanding their presence in India. India is the next big market for Apple. They're hoping to see growth there. There's, you know, 1.3 billion people living there. So part of the stuff that they're doing is localizing and catering to the market to sell more phones and hopefully grow their presence there as the country becomes more wealthy and has a growing middle class, much like we saw in China years ago. So the hope is that they'll have new growth opportunities there. Apple is building an app design and development center and development accelerator in India to encourage development of local apps that'll appeal to the market and help the iPhone and Apple's platforms appeal to users there.
They opened a map center.
They did. So there's going to be development of Apple Maps at a facility in India. And Tim Cook went there this week, hung out with a bunch of Bollywood celebrities, and looked like he had a grand old time there. There are a bunch of photos of him kind of partying it up in India. And
I want to see a Bollywood movie about Apple.
The Steve Jobs Bollywood story?
I do.
That would be interesting.
I watched a fantastic – there was a Bollywood NASCAR movie years ago that I watched. It was fantastic.
Yeah, you know
– It was Days of Thunder by Bollywood. And it was brilliant. It was Ricky Bobby as Bollywood. And I loved it. And I would love to see the Steve Jobs story from Bollywood.
Steve Jobs story with a big dance number at the end.
Yes.
4 hours long with an intermission.
Yes. Well, it'd be great.
So they're hoping that the fascination with Apple continues there. There's a lot of narratives underlying this, though. The Indian government has blocked Apple from importing used iPhones to sell there because they want devices to be manufactured in India. Foxconn's building a factory in India. So,
All of this is a legacy from the British colonialism days. You know, if you go back and you look at what happened when the British left, the BSA motorcycle, I'm blanking on the name, the Enfield, the Royal Enfield motorcycle, all of these British products that the British had brought over, the Indians basically took them over. And now the only place in the world that manufactures a Royal Enfield motorcycle, a British brand, is India, because it survived in India when the company died in the UK.
There's also an appeasement that has to go on with emerging markets. You've seen it in China, where Apple, you know, issued an apology to consumers there over certain practices years ago. You know, they have now invested in the ride sharing service over the taxi service Didi. So, you know, there's a lot of conspiracy theories that Apple is doing these types of things because they want to make nice with the Chinese government. And the same thing kind of going on in India. And I think that there's some truth to them. Where
I don't know that that's conspiracy or theory.
I mean, I think it's pretty obvious, but, you know, nobody can really say that's what we're doing. You know, it's kind of a tiptoeing around it. But I mean, let's be real. Tim Cook going over there, these facilities being opened up are a way for Apple to get some leverage and say to the Indian government, all right, guys, we opened up a facility. We're creating jobs there. We're going to start manufacturing with Foxconn in India. Now you need to let us open some retail stores, import some used phones.
We've complied with these rules. And
so bend the rules for us a little bit. Let us come in, sell these phones, do this kind of stuff. And there's rumors that Apple has plans to open its first 3 retail stores in India by the end of 2017. I think over the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to see that start to ramp up in much the same way they did in China. Again, you got 1.3 billion people in India. It's the most populous country in the world. And as their middle class starts to emerge and the country becomes a little more wealthy, Apple's hoping that their appetite for iPhones and other Apple products is going to grow as well.
Definitely. Speaking of products that are growing, the 9.7-inch iPad Pros landed over at B&H Photo with the Apple-authorized reseller slashing $50, $80, and even $100 off the 128-gig and 256-gig models. And those have free expedited shipping and no tax outside of the U.S. So if you look at our Apple Insider iPad price guide and take a look, you'll find that these deals are there for you. So go ahead and check out our iPad price guide and see our killer deals on the iPad Pro. Now, the iPhone 7 is shaping up to be a pretty complex product.
Supposedly.
Would you agree with that?
That's what the supply chain rumblings are, that Apple's suppliers are gearing up and hiring earlier than usual because they're expecting to have a more complex build for this year's iPhone 7. It may also be that Apple just wants to ramp up production more quickly this year so that they don't end up with supply constraints. I mean, you look how flat-footed they were caught this year with the iPhone SE. I mean, it still has a 2 to 3 week wait period if you're trying to order it. So I think that they want to make sure that they can get as many hands into the, and as many phones into the hands of consumers as they can at launch.
Well, I mean, just thinking about what the rumors say that this thing's going to have, it's going to have a dual camera. It could have the smart connector. It may or may not have the headphone jack. It's may or may not have an entirely new different cell modem inside.
Yeah.
Right? One of the rumors says that Intel is going to be responsible for 50% of the leaks, phones as opposed to
all
Qualcomm.
All the leaks suggest that the phone is going to look almost the same as the iPhone 6S and the iPhone 6 before, which a lot of people are going to be disappointed by. But I mean, geez, folks. The main issue is the antenna lines on the back are going to be changed. But other than that, looking largely the same. The rumor mill is pointing toward 2017 is when we're going to see a big change in the design of the iPhone with an all glass design. Potentially an edge-to-edge OLED display with the speaker grill and cameras somehow hidden behind the screen. I don't know how they're going to accomplish that, but that's what all the rumors have been saying, and that's the scuttlebutt. So for this year's model, kind of a evolutionary design, I think the most interesting thing to me and the one that may disappoint people the most is a lot of the rumors are claiming that these new features that are the most interesting, like the dual camera design and the smart connector, are only going to be found on the larger 5.6-inch plus model.
And you're a fan of the
smartphone. Yeah, I have no interest in buying iPhone 7 Plus. It's also expected they might just ditch the name iPhone 7 and just refer to them as iPhone and iPhone Pro. And so they would allow the iPhone Pro to stand out from the basic model by having a smart connector and having a dual camera design that would allow for much higher quality photos. It's expected that both are going to ditch the headphone jack and use either Bluetooth or lightning connected headphones. And the smaller phone would just have a single camera lens design and not have the smart connector on it. And the smart connector might be used for charging, especially charging while using headphones connected to the lightning jack. Who knows how these will shape out? I mean, it may be completely wrong, but that's what the rumor mill is suggesting right now. And it's expected to all launch by the end of September.
End of September.
Yep.
I can't wait, man. Well, is there anything else you'd like to discuss today?
I think we ran the gamut on that.
All right. Well, this has been the Apple Insider Podcast. Where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at This Is Neil.
And also at Apple Insider.
Yeah, if you want to read the stuff that I write, it's at Apple Insider. Yeah.
No one wants to do that. All right. Well, this has been the Apple Insider Podcast. You've wasted another perfectly good hour with us. And if Neil orders his iPhone 7 in September by placing it with voice through Google Home, we'll tell you all about it then on the Apple Insider Podcast.